Welcome to In the Moment. I'm Lori Walsh. John Hunter is publisher of the Madison Daily Leader. Jonathan Ellis is a reporter and columnist with the Sioux Falls Argus Leader. Today, together they comprise our panel of Dakota political junkies for the week. We've got no shortage of topics to address, so let's get started. John Hunter, welcome back to In the Moment.
Hi, Lori. Thanks for having me on today.
Thanks for being here as always. Jonathan Ellis, welcome as well.
Hey, thank you, Lori.
We're going to start out by playing a clip from Marty Jackley's press release to kick off this first topic earlier today. For those of you who have not heard, Attorney General Marty Jackley announced that Yoak Bolin has pled guilty to one count of unauthorized disposal of personal property subject to security interest. Bolin was sentenced to 2 years probation, $2,000 fine. As part of the plea, Bolin agrees to testify in any future case brought against this EB-5 incident. Here's a clip from Attorney General Marty Jackley's press conference early this morning.
Today, defendant Yoak Bolin has entered a plea of guilty to count one of the indictment that alleges essentially that in February of 2012, he had misused or disposed of a security interest that was designed to protect the state. It was in the amount of $300,000. Those funds were ultimately used to purchase TIF bonds here in Brown County. That as part of the plea, it is a felony, that he had accepted responsibility, admitted wrongdoing.
John Hunter, let's start with you. Now we've put it into a little bit of context. Let's say, how much does this announcement sort of resonate across the state, first of all?
Well, as you know, Lori, this particular issue has become politicized. It's become a Republican versus Democrat. Part of the reason of that is it happened, it was some sort of scandal, and it occurred during a Republican administration. And so it was part of the Senate campaign, Weiland and Mike Rounds. Since then, it's kind of been brought up as an example of by Democrats is why Republicans aren't fit to serve and so on. Anyway, it's, you know, ultimately it's not a Republican or a Democratic issue. It's a legal issue, and what Mr. Bolin did was illegal, and he has pleaded guilty to that. It won't satisfy the people who wanted to see all sorts of collateral damage from this and people being punished severely for this. Again, the legislature, the way it passes laws is for nonviolent crimes like this, there's a presumption of probation rather than of jail time, and so that's where that is. So how does it resonate? I think it's, you know, it, for supporters said it was a, you know, it was never that big a deal. They're saying, yep, it's not, but for detractors who thought it was a big deal, they would be unsatisfied.
Jonathan Ellis, does the conversation about EB-5 go away now?
Well, it's certainly receded over the years since the scandal first broke. It's not going to go away because there's still some civil lawsuits ongoing with regard to investors who feel like they were bilked out of their investments. So you have that going on. You've got still the unraveling of bankruptcy issues with the Northern Beef Packers plant, which was sort of the one project that sort of put a spotlight on the EB-5 program. You know, Yoak Bolin was sort of this unknown player until all of this sort of unraveled. So, I still think there's going to be some other things that come out. I mean, I certainly still have some lines in the water when it comes to EB-5, hoping to catch yet another fish here or there. So I think we'll hear more.
John Hunter, let's sort of pivot the conversation then. You mentioned it being politicized, sort of a conversation about ethics, which leads us to initiated Measure 22, voter-approved ballot initiative. Rick Weiland's name comes up there again.
Yes, and a nice segue, Lori, from between one topic and the other, because they're nicely related. This is kind of ethics reform and the charge that there's scandals currently, there's corruption in South Dakota government. That's essentially what IM-22 is kind of intended to go. But yes, it's become very politicized. It's especially the manner in which it's now, you know, it's essentially supported by Democrats, passed by the people. now being repealed by Republican legislature. It's hard, I think, for anyone to think clearly at this point about this because there's so much finger pointing and vitriol that goes with this. But this afternoon, I think the Senate will vote, and then it will go to the governor's desk after that.
So Senate votes on House Bill 1069, which is sort of the repeal law, not a replace law, but to repeal it. Has an emergency clause or the word emergency attached to it. John Hunter, I know you can explain to me what the emergency is here.
Well, I'll give it a swing.
All right.
There is a, the standard by which South Dakota legislative bills are passed is that they take effect on the following July 1st, after the legislative session goes through the veto-proof process and so on. This is a little bit more complicated because this law was passed by the voters, then there was an injunction placed on that right away, and then a lawsuit filed to overturn it. So the state, and I remember talking to Marty Jackley last week, and he is bound by law to the Attorney General's office to defend a law that's passed by the people. So South Dakota will be spending resources to defend that law, and they have already, as far as the lawsuit filed against it. And so I think legislators say, look, we're going to repeal and replace this thing. Let's not have it go for another 4 months or so, or 5 months until July 1st, in which a couple things could happen. One, it could go through court and be upheld, and you'd have one set of rules then for a few months and then change to whatever the legislature put in place after July 1st. Detractors, of course, argue that, no, they put the emergency clause in that to prevent us from referring that back to the voters, and so that's the political side of that. And again, talking to legislators last week, they were talking about this. It was really kind of dominating the legislative session. Mm. And the whole thing I remember saying is, the more distance there is between the repeal and the replace, the worse things are going to get. So if you could repeal it and have something ready to go and all that. But there will be, I think, negotiations about what that thing will look like after it's done. And so if you had a nice, clean replacement, or best-case scenario, Jonathan might chirp in here too, is that if you could have fixed the original thing and without having to repeal it, I think things would have been better.
Jonathan, what do you think there?
Well, I mean, initiated Measure 22 did a lot, and I think that if Republicans are going to replace parts of it, I think that we've seen support for an ethics commission of some kind, although not sort of an open-ended ethics commission that was approved in IM-22. I mean, there are some things in IM-22 that were simply just non-starters for Republican leaders, and so they're going to be, for example, publicly financed campaigns. So, they're going to have to be held. If they do repeal it, they're going to have to face whatever political consequences come with that. And my colleague Dana Ferguson, who's in Peer, is reporting today that there's a rally there as the Senate's going to take up the issue. They've got a plane flying around with a banner that's, telling them not to do it. So, the question is, are there going to be political consequences? With regard to the emergency clause, I mean, the Constitution allows the legislator to pass something with an emergency. It doesn't define what the emergency is. It just requires two-thirds votes. And so we can only assume that the emergency envisioned by lawmakers is that they're afraid the IM-22 backers are going to take over the state capitol and declare us a free Trump.
No. Or what could the emergency be other than that?
Right.
I'm not sure anyways. So tell me about this rally, Jonathan Ellis. What do you know? Who's who's paying for the plane to fly overhead with a banner?
Well, there's a organization that's been involved in. There were some out of state organizations that were involved. To Represent Us, I think, was one of them, and that kind of financed some of these campaign measures. So they would be involved more than likely in financing this. I mean, they've run ads in newspapers. They have tried to gin up support and to let lawmakers know that if they do this, that there is going to be a political consequence to pay for this. Whether or not that actually happens, I mean, you know, the election is not, again, there's a whole other legislative cycle before there is another election. So, you know, whether or not there will be a consequence, we'll see. But if history is to show us when this has happened in the past, this isn't the first time the legislature, you know, has repealed something that voters passed. You know, there was not in the past a political consequence to when the legislature did repeal a voter-approved initiative.
John Hunter, is it just me, or has this gotten a little nastier than maybe necessary?
Well, yeah, that's a good question, and it has gotten nasty, and I know the phone calls that legislators receive are harsh, I think probably on both sides, but that's a little bit of the era that we seem to be in, right? It's kind of what's happened at the national level, that the discourse has become more harsh and accusatory and personal and all those kinds of things, and so I think this kind of reflects at least a little bit about what's happening nationally as well. I don't know if it was influenced by that. It's possible. But yes, I do think it's, and to be fair, it's been rough on legislators. Remember, not all of them are sponsoring this, and so people who are just ready to vote are getting calls and other kinds of communication. It can be difficult to be a legislator this session because of this.
Are they getting calls from voters who say they didn't understand what they voted for and please repeal it? Do you think they're getting calls on each side? You said each side. Do you think that's?
You know, I don't know.
Yeah. I'm curious to know what those phone calls are.
Legislators have only told me that they get them from both sides, and that whether it's 10-1 or 1-1, I don't know. But I would guess, and Jonathan might guess too, on that most of them would be supporting the supporters of IM-22. They are really rallied for this.
Jonathan Ellis, what are sort of the bare bones minimum replace legislation that needs to happen to satisfy voters, or can nothing satisfy the voters now that it's become politicized as it has?
Well, I think it's important to differentiate here a little bit. I mean, there are the hardcore IM-22 supporters, and nothing will satisfy them if anything is repealed. Okay, so but I honestly think that that's a small but very vocal group of people. As if you look at the voters at large, I mean, it's a much bigger pool of people who don't have as much invested in this issue. I mean, I think that. Again, if the Republicans were to create some kind of ethics commission that wasn't just sort of a paper tiger, that actually had some real ability to enforce campaign-ish, you know, ethics in campaign finance, and if you want to go to lobbyists, that as well, I think that would, for again, that broad pool of voters would be pretty appealing to them and satisfying to them. But for the real hardcore, the people who are behind IM-22, there were other issues than just the Ethics Commission. And so any kind of repeal for them would not be acceptable.
John, does settlement of the Yoke Bolin case move this conversation forward, or does it come at a time that just adds to the sort of tumultuous conversation?
I think it'll add slightly to the tumult and of this conversation. But part of the thing that I think people wanted, you know, they want corruption-free government, right? I mean, if you see this huge thing, and it looked as though it was going to put some things in place for that. The fact that both Gear Up and EB-5 occurred, that I think South Dakotans don't want those to happen again. So whatever, if more of them come up, then voters of all sorts would say, well, that, you know, the repeal in place didn't work because another thing has surfaced. If now we go great lengths without any scandals or any kind of corruption, they say, well, maybe that the repeal and replace worked.
Mm. Jonathan Ellis makes national news, was in the Washington Post the other day, and other news organizations. How does that sort of add to the conversation? Do we care that the rest of the country is watching?
When you say we, I mean, I'm slipping into philosophy
again here. Do we really? Yeah, right. Sorry.
Frankly, I think the lawmakers in Pure, those who've been around for a while, are used to having some national exposure when our legislature's in session, because there's usually something. We go early as a legislature. We go quickly and we get things kind of done, and that means whatever controversies that you see pop up in legislatures across the country, they tend to happen here first. So they're used to some of this national attention. Now, granted, this is an organic controversy versus some of the other ones we've seen in the past, and so I don't know that how much influence that has. I mean, I've seen some of the reporting on the how it's been reported nationally, and some of them neglect to mention that there was any kind of court action done. Some of them just assume, some of the reporting has been neglecting to mention that issue, and I think that's important context, that you have to understand that there has been a judge who's decided that some of this is unconstitutional. Mm-hmm. So without that context of that reporting, it just looks like a bunch of lawmakers who are trying to repeal this thing. Especially the veteran lawmakers up there who go through this process, been through this process multiple times, they're used to having some kind of national exposure on what we're doing in the South Dakota legislature, just by the nature of our legislature.
Let's take another national conversation then and bring it to the State House and talk about Senate Bill 124. And this has to do with refugee resettlement, having this conversation in a week after President Trump issued his executive orders that affect refugees. John Hunter, do you want to talk about what lawmakers are sort of hoping to do with the power to veto refugee resettlement in South Dakota? What do you know?
Well, I wish I knew more. The settlement, refugee resettlement issue is more complicated, but certainly thrown into the spotlight with the travel ban. But South Dakota has welcomed immigrants for its entire history, and frankly has done a really good job about being able to resettle and assimilate people from all parts of the world. And it's currently happening, and it tends to happen pretty well. It can be done right, and if you use the resources, and there are some resources, probably not enough from some people's standpoint to be able to do this right, then it's a great deal. And I hope that, it's just a personal hope that the spotlight on this thing will cause South Dakota to try to be the best resettlement state that there is, not the biggest, but to be able to do it right. Mm-hmm. And I think it's possible. I think it can be done here.
Jonathan Ellis, you live in a city of Sioux Falls that's been referred to as the Ellis Island of the Prairie. There's a mural in Whittier neighborhood with the Statue of Liberty sort of referring to that. How has this resonated in Sioux Falls?
It depends on where you go. I think there's certainly, again, there are vocal minorities who are very upset about this. I've seen some polling where a majority, or maybe a plurality, I should say, of people sort of agree with the travel ban. What the legislature is trying to do is interesting to me with Senate Bill 124, and that's that, currently the Department of Social Services kind of entering into contracts with refugee resettlement under federal law, and that's, that's Lutheran Social Services. And the legislature is trying to eliminate that and say, hey, the legislature's got to be the one that approves any refugee resettlements. That's kind of interesting. That's fairly activist for the legislature to do. Senate Bill 124 would have passed. So, Sioux Falls, I've been here for about 11 years now, and the diversity of Sioux Falls has certainly grown a lot just in that amount of time frame. I think that by and large, Sioux Falls has been a very accommodating and hospitable city, and I would not expect that to change.
Jonathan Ellis is a reporter and columnist with the Sioux Falls Argus Leader. Jonathan, thanks for being here today.
Thanks, Lori.
And John Hunter, publisher of the Madison Daily Leader. Thank you as well, sir.
Thanks, Lori.
Welcome back to In the Moment. I'm Lori Walsh. South Dakota State Representative Ray Ring is a Democrat from Vermilion. Representative Ring is introducing a bill to cut the sales tax on food. He joins us today from Pierre to talk about it. Representative Ring, welcome to In the Moment.
Thank you very much. Thank you for having me.
Tell me what you're hoping to put forth.
Well, what we'd like to do is exempt food from the sales tax in South Dakota. That is grocery food, not prepared food, not restaurant food, just food for home consumption. And then to replace the revenue that we've lost, we raised the overall sales tax rate by about 0.35%. So it would be a revenue neutral change, but would take some of the burden, the disproportionate burden on low-income people off of them by exempting food, which of course is a necessity.
Give me an idea of why it's so important for you to bring it up this year in the State House.
Well, I think it's important to bring it up every year because it's puts a burden on people every year. Just as an example, the study that I have from the Institute on Taxation and Economic Policy, which probably does as good a job as any I know of at looking at this issue, in looking at total taxes in South Dakota, state and local taxes, not federal, just state and local taxes. If you compare South Dakota to the 50-state average, for the lowest income 20% of people, we actually have a higher tax burden, taxes as a percent of income, on the bottom 20%, and lower taxes as a percent of income on everybody else. So overall, the tax structure puts a heavier burden on low-income people and a much, much lighter burden on the top 1%.
How does Oh, go ahead. Sorry.
To relate that to taxes, to food, the 4% sales tax, I did these before we raised the rate, the sales tax on food in 2014 accounted for almost 1% of income for those people in the lowest 20%. So 1% doesn't sound like a lot, but when we're talking about people with incomes generally below $20,000, people who are living really right at the margin, the 1%, and that's not 1% food spending, that's the tax on food spending on the lowest income people, is quite heavy. And I won't bore you with all the rest of the quintiles, but the point is that this would pretty significantly lower the tax burden on those lower income people.
How does the fact that South Dakota does not have an income tax, play into these calculations?
Well, most other states have an income tax, and generally, the income tax puts a lower burden on low-income people and a higher burden on higher-income people, particularly the lowest-income people because of the standard deduction and the personal exemption, whereas pretty much your first dollar of spending is subject to the sales tax. So the fact that we don't have an income tax means that we have to use the sales tax more broadly. And we do have one of the most comprehensive, to use an economist's jargon, one of the most comprehensive sales tax bases in the country, both on consumers and on businesses. And so we have to rely more on that and on the property tax because we don't use the income tax.
What do you think the consequences, if you could spin it forward a couple years or even a decade, what would be the consequences of exempting food from the sales tax and replacing that revenue with an overall 3.5% sales tax increase? Can you go out and project what you think those consequences would be down the road?
Not 3.5%, 0.35%.
0.35, I got that wrong. Yep. My apologies. 0.35,
yeah. Right. But that's about what it would take to replace the lost revenue from the tax on food. What would be the consequences?
Mm-hmm. Long term.
Long term, the sales tax would grow a little bit more rapidly because as incomes go up, people tend to spend more, so there'd be more sales tax, but the consumption of food doesn't depend all that much on income because it's a necessity. And so the sales tax would probably grow a little bit more rapidly, not a lot. Otherwise, I don't think it would. And of course, it would take some of the burden off of low-income people. I don't think it would have a lot of other long-term impacts.
Hmm. What's the response been from fellow lawmakers?
Well, I've brought this bill. This will be the third year, and I haven't gotten it out of committee yet.
How come?
There's not a lot of support. There's a great reluctance to raise taxes anytime, of course. And we would have to raise the sales tax rate. We'd lower it more than proportionately on lower income people. There's just a reluctance to raise tax rates. I mean, if you remember a year ago, we were helping virtually every public school teacher in the state, and we barely got that one through. So it would be a struggle.
Hmm. What do you think the increase for teacher pay, did that have an impact on low-income families in the state? Are you hearing that from constituents?
I wouldn't say I've heard that from constituents. There's no question that since the sales tax generally is more regressive, puts a higher proportionate burden on low-income people, means that raising it half a percentage point did put more of a burden on them proportionately than it put on higher income people. And so the 1% that I cited a while ago for food, since would in fact should be probably 1.1, 1.2%, something like that now, because we did add that. And yes, that came up on the floor of the legislature, that we would be doing that. And part of my response was, well, I know one way to make that not quite the increase, not quite so burdensome on people. Let's lower the tax on food.
So if it doesn't gain a lot of traction with fellow lawmakers, tell me as we just close out today why it's important to keep having the conversation.
Because it's important to have the overall conversation that we have a tax structure that puts a great burden on lower-income people. The ITEP that I cited before counts this as number 4 of the terrible 10 as far as our overall tax structure is concerned. The other point that I'd throw in, I bring this because I think it makes the point about our tax structure as well as anything, but we also tax business inputs much more than most other states, and I think that's also a detriment to economic development. One more piece of data that I'll give you, only about 7 states left in the country continue to fully tax food, and there are about 6 states that tax at less than the full rate, and a lot of those are gradually phasing out the sales tax on food. When I started looking at these things 30 or so years ago, about half the states taxed food. We're now down to, as I said, 7 states that fully tax food. So that's the direction we've been going, and I think South Dakota should join that trend.
Ray Ring is a representative to the South Dakota State House. He's from Vermilion. Representative Ring, thank you for joining us today.
Thank you very much for the opportunity.
Welcome back to In the Moment. I'm Lori Walsh. Mike Meyer is now the field manager for the American Association's Sioux Falls Canaries baseball team. He's no stranger to the organization or to the game. He joins us now from Tucson, Arizona, to talk about the upcoming season. Mike Meyer, welcome to In the Moment.
Well, thanks for having me. I really appreciate the time.
Tell me what kind of team you are inheriting.
Yeah, well, six consecutive losing seasons. You know, it's been kind of a tough stretch there for the last few years. But it's got some good bones to the roster. We're bringing back quite a few of the guys. We've got some really good young talent. And my job right now is to kind of bring in some veteran guys, some top-tier talent to put around the young talent there and build a complete roster. The last couple of years they've had, you know, a decent lineup in some spots, you know, but they just didn't have the depth. And same with the pitching staff, a couple really good starting pitchers, but, you know, didn't have that quality five-man rotation. And that's what we're looking to bring and be competitive in the North Division.
Now, you have a history with the Sioux Falls Canaries. Remind us, you were there from 2007 to 2014. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's correct. I spent 8 years there as a pitching coach, and we had a lot of success. Our first 5 years there, we actually won more games than any team in our league during that time. We also won the 2008 American Association Championship and went back to the championship series in 2010. So we had quite a bit of success there. You know, we kind of strayed from our formula a little bit the last couple of years, but we're looking to get that back. We really want to pack the roster with young, signable talent. We want to try to sell as many players as we can back to organizations because what it'll do is it'll send a message to the rest of the teams in our division, in our league, you know, that, hey, this is the place you want to come if you want to have another opportunity or get your first chance to get to an organization, then Sioux Falls is a place for you. And that's our goals, and that's what we're going to try to do.
So how do you build that complete roster? How do you convince young players or top-tier players to come and play for the Canaries? What are those conversations like?
Well, for me, it's all about honesty. I'm upfront with my players. I tell them some of the negatives that come with in the past in Sioux Falls and a lot of the positives that we brought to the table earlier and what it is that I want to do and where we want to go. I tell them that you can't trust anybody in baseball. I know this for a fact. Being a former player, everybody's going to try to sell you, you know, something. So I tell them, don't trust what I'm saying. Try to find somebody that's played for me in the past that knows me and to see if I'm telling the truth or if I'm full of it. You know, and so far it's been working really well. Obviously, we're not going to land every guy we're going after, but if we can start to get that reputation, even with the guys that we don't say land this time around, you know, hopefully they still enjoy their conversations with me and with us and what it is that we're trying to do there. And you know, when they have a friend of theirs that gets released out of AA, you know, and they call them, hey, you're an indie ball guy, you know, who do you recommend? And hopefully our name keeps coming up. And that's the goal, you know. So I want to make sure that I'm telling these guys the truth and I'm honest with evaluating where I see them going and what it is I want from them. And, you know, hopefully we build that reputation of being, you know, the place that these players can trust and they know that we're going to do everything we can to better their careers. And that's our goal.
Let's talk about your staff. Includes first-year pitching coach Ben Moore. What did it take to separate him from the Laredo team and bring him to Sioux Falls?
Yeah, well, he's, tremendous. You know, obviously, he spent 6 years pitching for me in Sioux Falls, and he's got every Sioux Falls Canary record. He's got all the American Association records. He's, in a lot of people's minds, including myself, he's the greatest independent pitcher in the history of independent baseball. So he's got the playing pedigree, but he spent 2015 season in Washington with the Washington Wild Things of the Frontier League. As the pitching coach, and I heard, you know, great things from over there. And when the opportunity came about, I was, you know, in Laredo in 15, and then in 16, talking with Incavillo, the manager down there, I switched over to the hitting side, and we brought Ben in to be the pitching guy, and he did a tremendous job with us down there. At this point, I believe we've had six pitchers off of that roster get signed back to an organization, so. You know, he's really, really good, you know, relating to these younger, you know, pitchers. You know, he's just fresh out. I think his last year pitching was 14. So it's not like he's this old guy, you know. He's, I'm a little bit more of an old school type guy. You know, I use my eyes a little bit more where, you know, nowadays there's analytics and that's, you know, Ben's forte. He's tremendous at researching and using some of the statistics to, you know, analyze guys and see what they need to do better. So I think between the two of us, it's going to be a great mix for a lot of the young arms that we're going to be able to attract.
Today's announcement about Blake Schmidt. Tell me about his. Tell me about
him.
Yeah,
Blake Schmidt. Yeah, he's great. Great addition to our roster.
Yeah.
Blake was the shortstop last year. He was the lone all-star. Younger guy. He's from Eden Prairie, Minnesota, so he's relatively local. He's a grinder. You know, he's got a lot of a nice tool set. He's got some speed. He can really hit. He's the best defensive shortstop in the league. But he's also a grinder type. You know, he doesn't give away at bats. He's going to work the counts. He's going to really put pressure on the opposing pitching staffs. And we ended up landing Chris Jacobs, who's, you know, was the best power threat in the Can-Am League last year. And then we also acquired Burt Reynolds, who was the home run king from the American Association last year. So we've got those two guys behind Blake. Hopefully he's going to be able to get on for us and steal some bags. And we'll have those two guys to drive him in. So he's a big, big piece for us. He's played shortstop, which is a premium position. So to have a defensive shortstop as good as he is, but be able to put up the offensive numbers is really a nice thing to have.
So the roster is stacking up pretty nicely, it looks, at least on paper. Give us an idea of your vision for this team, 4 months almost out from the home opener.
Yeah, we are a lot farther along than I was anticipating. Our lineup is really shoring up. You know, we're still missing a couple of pieces. I need a couple of outfielders and maybe a corner infielder. You know, maybe two big sticks in the middle of the lineup yet. But I like some of the pieces that we're bringing back. We got Pat Fiala, who's a Sioux Falls kid, went to Augie. He's going to be a big piece in the middle of our lineup. He's going to play third base for us. So, you know, we got some young, you know, talented guys in our lineup. But I'm really actually excited about our pitching staff. We're a lot further along than I was anticipating at this point. We got Joe Bircher, who starting pitcher in the league last year. He's going to be back with us. I believe Dylan Thompson, we're really close to getting his contract finalized. He's a young sinker baller. He's going to be a big piece in our rotation. And we're stacking up. Our bullpen is coming around really nice with Josh Farrell, left-handed reliever, and Billy Waltrip is going to be a slim guy for us. You know, he's got a ton of strikeouts, but we're going to see if we can't put him in the starting rotation and maybe get him into a little bit better rhythm earlier. He has a tendency to kind of be a little loose when he comes out of the bullpen for the first hitter or two, so if we can get him in the rotation, hopefully we can drop some of those walks down and keep those strikeouts up there. So, you know, we're stacking up pretty well. I mean, obviously we still have, you know, quite a bit of time here, and we're going to make a big push when Major League Baseball spring training starts up. They'll start to release some of their guys, and that's where we're going to land the last pieces that we need. But I like where we're at so far.
All right, let's leave it there. Mike Meyer, thanks so much. We drove to work in the snow today, and now we're all imagining baseball. So thanks for being with us today.
All right, thanks for having me on. I really appreciate it.
Steve Metley was a city planner. He worked for 31 years for 5 different mayors in the city of Sioux Falls. Steve Metley died this week at the age of 71. We wanted to know more about Metley's legacy in shaping the city of Sioux Falls, so we decided to ask the man who hired him. Rick Nobe was elected mayor of the city in 1974. He's a longtime radio broadcaster, civic leader, and friend to Steve Metley. And in the interest of full disclosure, Rick Nobe also serves on the Educational Telecommunications Board for South Dakota Public Broadcasting. He joins us now via phone. Rick, welcome to In the Moment.
Hey, thank you very much for asking me. I am pleased and honored to be with you.
And I'm sorry about the loss of your friend, Steve Metley. I did not know him except by reputation.
Well, and thank you for that. Steve, his reputation goes a long, long ways out, and those of us who knew him, he was a very gentle man. He's a big guy, but he was a gentle guy, and he was very visionary, and he was easy to work with and easy to be around.
Mm. You hired him. Tell me that story, because he was already going to get hired. Is that what I understand?
Well, yeah, there was some speculation about whether he was going to get hired as city planning director or not. What politics happened in 1974, and a gentleman who was mayor lost the election, and I won. And I had heard about Steve through various other people, and I went and talked with him, and we just hit it off right away. We were about the same age. We were in our mid-20s. We were young enough to not know what we couldn't do. You know, there was nothing we didn't think we thought we could do everything. And we just teamed up, and it was a great combination of things. And we got a lot of stuff done.
Hmm. 1974 in Sioux Falls. Paint a picture for me of what the city is like then.
1974, 41st Street, where the Empire Mall was an alfalfa field. 41st Street in that particular area was a two-lane, pretty much either township or county road. The western city limits went just a little bit past Interstate 29. 57th Street was a gravel road. 49th Street didn't exist. On the east side of town, you got over to about Sycamore Avenue, and you were in cornfields.
Hmm. So what are some of those early conversations about thinking what could become, you know, of the city in the years ahead? What were you guys talking about back then in your mid-20s?
Well, we both had figured out that the city was pretty much reacting to things that were going on. Rather than being an actor, we were reacting. And one of the things that was on the community plate in the early part of the 1970s was what to do with the Big Sioux River. It had fallen into, it was really polluted. It was the falls of the Big Sioux River. Falls Park was not a park. It was not a place you wanted to go after dark. And even in the daytime, you didn't want to be down there by yourself. Lots of industry down there that was just not a good place. And the community had wanted to do something with the Big Sioux River, but there just wasn't the political momentum to make it happen. And I came along, I hired Steve, the two of us working with a lot of other people. It wasn't just him and me. We put together the Big Sioux River Greenway Plan, and the rest, as they say, is history, because now Sioux Falls is actually proud of the falls of the Big Sioux River.
Mm. What was he like for building relationships then, if he had to sort of cross a lot of boundaries there and get a lot of people on a new team?
It was really interesting. I was thinking about this before this interview started, and Steve and I were in our 20s. Everybody else we worked with at City Hall was either old enough to be our father or in some cases could have been our grandparents. Hmm. And so here's these two young guys that come in, and we made some changes, and some people came along willingly. Some people, it took them a little time to come along, but we eventually pretty much got on the same page, and we got the Big Sioux River Greenway project going. We did the first comprehensive plan for the city. Years later, we started talking about capital improvement projects and how to focus on those and prioritize those. We started dealing with drainage issues long before it was fashionable. And so in working with downtown was basically dead in 1974 because of the change in the world with automobiles and suburbia and stuff. And now I think most people would say downtown is a happening place. And Steve was a major player in making that transition.
And that's where he lived at the end of his life. Is that correct?
Yeah, it was really interesting in a very positive way. He ended his life living on Phillips Avenue north of 6th Street. And at the time he and I were elected, that was a salvage yard. Hmm. And a lumber yard was in there, too. And the street didn't exist. And I just I found it interesting that that's where he chose to live. It was a good decision. He loved downtown.
31 years, he works for five different mayors as a city planner. You keep in touch with him that whole time and sort of have conversations about what's happening in the city now?
Yes, we did. We were joined at the hip from 1974 to 1984 when I was mayor. We spent a lot of time together because we needed to change the dynamic of things. And after that, we had regular visits, regular conversations. I knew what he was involved in. He knew what I was involved in. And losing him is kind of, I've got two brothers. I haven't lost either one of them, but I feel like I've lost a brother.
Hmm. We've got a couple minutes left, and I'm wondering if you could just tell me what kind of friend he was.
He was really, as I said at the beginning, he was just really a very gentle man. I never heard him say anything really harsh against anybody. I doubt if he cussed. I don't remember him cussing. He just always was looking on the positive side of things. How can we get things done? How can we make some whatever is? How can we make it better? And I think he approached his friendships like that too. He and I were, as I said, really close when I was in office. And we didn't have to maintain that relationship afterwards because he was working for other mayors and doing other things. And yet that bond continued up until the time he passed away.
His legacy for the city of Sioux Falls, and then does that legacy extend to the rest of the state?
Oh, I think his legacy will be viewed as the Big Sioux River Greenway is probably the biggest thing that people know about. And as I said, he was one of the major players in making that happen. And then the revitalization of downtown is a huge deal. And then the orderly growth of the city, which is pretty mundane to a lot of people. But by doing it the way we did it, we kept taxes down, we kept services up, and Sioux Falls eventually became one of the best cities in America to live in and still is today. And Steve was a part of taking a good city and making it great.
Rick Nobe was mayor of the city of Sioux Falls from 1974 to 1984. We've been talking about Steve Metley, who was a city planner for 31 years for the city of Sioux Falls. He died this week at the age of 71. Rick Nobe, we appreciate your time today. Thanks for being with us.
Lori, thank you for the opportunity.